It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Paula Poundstone has been making people laugh professionally for more than 30 years. Public radio listeners know her as a regular panelist on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and she still travels extensively doing stand-up. She's coming back to Iowa. She'll be performing at the Englert Theater in Iowa City on Friday, June 10th, and she is here with me today. Paula, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you very much. I'm looking forward to coming to Iowa City.
Now, I mentioned that you've been making people laugh professionally for more than 30 years. And of course, I'm sure on an amateur level, you were making people laugh before that as well. But what drew you into doing stand-up comedy?
Well, the first sentence of the last paragraph of the summary letter written by my kindergarten teacher, Mrs. Bump, in May of 1965, says, "I've enjoyed many of Paula's humorous comments about our activities." Mrs. Bump encouraged me from kindergarten.
When did you get the idea that this was something that you could do and make a living at?
I grew up listening to some great comedy albums. I can't remember what grade I was in, maybe, fifth grade or so, when the show Laugh-In was really popular. And so, I had seen some really great comics. I think I thought that I would be a comic actress, a sketch comedy person. Is what I, I wanted to be Carol Burnett, for example, and I missed by a country mile. But I happened to really, to some degree, it was time and place. I happened to be working bussing tables in Boston, which was not a hard job to turn my back on. And in 1979, and a couple of guys started, open mic nights and a comedy circuit there, and so I saw some people doing that, and I joined in.
You mentioned a nice, encouraging letter from your kindergarten teacher. I have read that you left high school before you finished. Was school something that just didn't work for you? What prompted you to leave?
I was a total loser. That's what prompted me to leave. I was hideously depressed. I just sort of oozed out of high school. It wasn't like a defiant, I've got greener grass kind of a maneuver. It was just sort of like, I was very lucky because I was raised in Massachusetts, and Massachusetts had really great schools, and I had a lot of really, really terrific, and caring teachers, and I had all sorts of people reaching out and trying to help me, and I was just a disaster. So I more sort of, stopped performing high school tasks than anything else. And then I was, once I was bussing tables for a living, I think I got some solid ground under my feet. By the way, I'm a gifted table busser. I happen to be riddled with OCD, and so it makes me a fantastic table busser, perhaps the best there ever was. When I left the restaurant where I bussed tables, I had to hire two people because I was thorough. And I started doing, stand-up young enough that, I think my thought, if I had any, prior to that, was, I might sort of, work my way up in restaurants. I mean, that's about where I was at when I happened to stumble into this open mic circuit in Boston. And then after that, my sort of old idea, being a comic, was like, if some of the people before my time would go into strip clubs and ask if they could do 5 minutes of stand-up on a strip club stage, or they would go into a club that was, wasn't a comedy show per se, and ask if they could do time there. I never would have had the nerve to do that. I just wouldn't. And therefore, had someone not sort of stomped the ground down a bit, already broken the trail before me, I imagine I would be an incredibly gifted table busser by now.
You have a reputation with your stand-up show of never performing the same act twice. You are very spontaneous. You're also known for really being able to interact with the audience in a very spontaneous and funny way. Is that something that you developed early on, the ability to react to the people around you?
Yeah, when I started doing open mics, the premise was anybody who wanted to could go on and do 5 minutes. And so I would write down, my 5 minutes. I would memorize it. If you look carefully while I was bussing tables, you'd notice my lips moving. And then I would go on stage and promptly forget you know, just out of sheer nerves, what I had intended to say. Or I would get distracted by something in front of me and say something else entirely. So there were two things happening. You know, one thing is that I had a tendency to just sort of respond to what was in front of me from the start. And the other is that I also had a tendency to go totally blank. I have no memory. I really suck at memorizing. And so I would often be in a situation where I was like, well, I have to say something. And I don't know what day it dawned on me that that was where the real heart and soul of what I was doing lie, or perhaps it's lay. The really fun part, the part that is unique to that particular evening, and it was more, as opposed to developing it, I more allowed myself to do it. I decided that it wasn't a bad thing after all. I have 37 years of material rattling around in my head somewhere, but I do the time-honored, where are you from, what do you do for a living, and in this way, little biographies of audience members emerge. It's from which I set my sails, you know. It's sort of like it when you're at a cocktail party. Are you saying sometimes things you've said before? Absolutely. It's just that something inspires you to say them at one time or another. And then there's stuff that I say that is unique only to that night and will never be, shall never be repeated.
Now, you say you don't remember exactly when you realized that was kind of the heart and soul of what you were doing, but do you have an early experience of interacting with an audience member at a club that you remember as being a moment where you thought, wow, that's something that I'm really good at. I really nailed that.
No, I don't think I do. It's just sort of eased into being, you know. I used to have a great memory for lots of, you know, there was a time where you could mention to me any night and I could tell you who I had talked to in the audience. But I don't know, I passed that line a number of years ago now, I guess, because now I really don't remember them all individually. People come up and tell me about a particular night or say, oh, you know, you talked to me in the audience one night, and they'll describe it. And I go, really? I'm glad I did. I don't remember. There's been lots of really great people. And fortunately, any number of times, some sort of recording machine has been running during those exchanges. I have a couple of CDs out, one called I Heart Jokes, Paul Tells Him in Maine, and one called I Heart Jokes, Paul Tells Him in Boston. And in the Maine one, I was working in a town called Brownfield, Maine, and I got, you know, there's a guy, I said, what do you do for a living? And he said he was a snow ranger, which I had never heard of. Still haven't heard of it again. But so the snow ranger, fortunately, and his wife, by the way, managed the forest, which is something I've also not ever heard before. When I think manager, I think, you know, something spilled on aisle 9. Both of those people were fortunately captured on that CD. Well, certainly one of the most well-known ones. I was working, I was taping an HBO special in San Francisco. A woman told a story, as I prompted her to, I really dragged it out of her, about her mother's mother having an accident at an auto repair shop. And when I pushed her to tell me what happened, it turned out her mother's face was ripped off on a lube rack, which for some odd reason, in the moment, struck everyone as hysterically funny. It is probably, because it was on an HBO special, the most well-known audience interaction that I've ever had. And in my head, I was thinking, oh, my God, HBO will never forgive me for making this woman say this. And it turned out, I don't know why, but there was something about maybe just the moment that she said it or perhaps my reaction of horror that made it just this really funny thing. People come up to me all the time. They think it was like a routine.
Oh, my.
People come up and they go, oh, remember the night you did the piece about the, you know, woman's face being ripped off in the loop rack? I go, yeah, that's not a piece. Yeah, I don't repeat that. No, that was just that night.
I guess that just reinforces the aphorism that tragedy plus time equals comedy.
But yeah, I suppose. Certainly seemed that way that night anyways. Even the woman, the mother with the ripped off face wasn't there, but even the woman was laughing. It came because she was, originally I said, I guess somebody had said that they were a lawyer in the crowd. And I said, when the guy said he was a lawyer, this lady over on the other side of the room goes like, ah. And I was like, okay, there's a story there. I go, okay, what is it you don't like about lawyers so much? I said, well, I had to deal with lawyers a lot. And I said, well, why did you have to deal with it? And I kept like hammering her until finally she blurted out that her mother's face was ripped off in a lube rack. And I don't know.
Wow.
From there, there was happiness. Go figure.
So over the years, you've done comedy on a lot of different topics. You do a lot of personal comedy. You've talk a lot about your cats, for example. That's something that I feel a real connection with you over, being also a cat lady myself. And you've also, people remember that you were arrested for alcoholism or for driving under the influence a little over 10 years ago now. You have also, okay, I'm sorry.
I just like it to be as far away from me as possible.
Yes, understandable. And you've also kind of laid your soul bare about that, and you've done comedy related to that and talked a lot about it. You also have done a lot of political comedy over the years. And of course, on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, you respond to a lot of current events and a lot of politics. And those seem like very different kinds of comedy to me, the deep personal stuff and the political stuff. Is it different to you?
No, not really. I guess I consider the political stuff autobiographical as well. Here's why. Because it's part of being an adult in our society. You know, you're supposed to vote. You're supposed to do a well-considered vote. And so I do try to keep up. And by the way, with a mixture of failure and success, for sure, there are times where I'm very well apprised of you know, what's going on. I'm not I shouldn't say very well apprised, but well apprised, I suppose, of what's going on in the world. And then there are times where my personal drama, overwhelms my ability to pay attention to the news. I'm not a surrogate. I'm not campaigning for anybody, right? I'm just making jokes. I have a tendency to make the jokes about the people that I think are funny. So, I don't know. I do consider it sort of autobiographical. I'm talking about what I saw and how I interpreted it.
With this election cycle, you know, comedians obviously always have a lot of fun with politics and political candidates. With this election cycle, it sort of feels like comedians almost can't go farther than the candidates themselves have gone.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, to some degree, you don't have to write jokes. You just have to take notes. You know, you just have to remember what they said. Yeah, it's true. Any comedian worth their salt would, I believe, you know, people say to me all the time, oh, isn't this great for comedy? Isn't this great for comedy? I'm a citizen before I'm a comic. I'm a human being before I'm a comic. I would really like for reasonable people with differences of opinion about how you solve the problems that we need to solve be running for office. And then we choose who we trust, who we feel good about, who we think would be a good president, but we choose the way of solving the problem that we think is the best way of solving the problem, but it's put forth by reasonable human beings. That's what would be good for the country. That's what would be good for the world. And the part where, oh, isn't it funny? You know what? We'll think of other things to make jokes about. Thanks. We don't need the world to suck to make jokes.
There will always be cats, right?
I don't consider it good news. You know, sometimes people say that to me. They'll be like, oh, isn't it great? No, it's horrible. What, are you kidding me? It's horrible. We're frightening other countries. We've stumbled upon a bee's nest of discontent. And discontent isn't even a strong enough word, you know. I mean, Donald Trump said it himself. He said, I love the uneducated. No, I love the poorly educated. That's what he said. I think we're getting the comeuppance for doing a lousy job at lots of things for many years. And no, I don't think it's good news. I, it's hard not to make fun of Donald Trump because you're right. He just puts it out there. You can hardly help yourself. Or any of them with their, you know, I don't know.
We're almost out of time, but I want to ask you something that I was wondering about not that long ago. You've been telling stories about your cats for a very long time. You're pretty famous for telling stories about your cats. Comedian Marc Maron has also really carved out a niche in telling stories about his cats and the feral cats in his neighborhood. Do you feel at all like he's treading on your feline turf?
No, I actually, I went to Marc Maron's house. I did an interview with Marc Maron, or Marc Maron did an interview with me, I guess, or something like that. And I went to Marc Maron's house. And let me tell you, you know, because people said to me, oh, you know, he has a lot of cats. I'm like, you're kidding me. There's not a lot of cats. This guy knows nothing about being overwhelmed by cats. No, he was delightful, and I enjoyed being interviewed by him. But I would have to question his multiple cat credentials. I have 14.
You actually call into question my multiple cat credentials. I only have 9, so.
Oh, my gosh. Well, let me tell you. Stop right there. Don't get any more. I'm telling you.
I should have stopped 3 cats ago. I know this.
Honestly, even as we're talking, I swear to you, I'm standing in my kitchen. I'm leaning on the little desk underneath the phone, and I'm looking over at there's a kind of a cabinet underneath a bench that's at the table, and I realize I think there's cat pee there on the floor. And so while I'm doing an interview with you, I walk over with a damp cloth and I'm wiping up this area. That is my whole life. Everywhere I go, I'm looking for I'm always looking for cat pee. It's sort of an odd kind of foraging. I just always have a sharp eye out for it, you know.
But they're so fuzzy and cute.
They are that. Although one of them also, while I was talking to you, I had to walk in the other room and spray one with a water bottle to get it shut up. Because my cat, Harrison, has taken in the morning. Now she was standing in front of my he was standing in front of my daughter's room crying. But before that, he was standing in front of my room crying. Not because he's hungry. Not because he needs food. Because the food is already out there. He wants a different kind of food. That's a bit much. And you'd think he was starving the way he's crying. No, there's food out. And he's not even going to eat it, by the way. He likes to know that it's there.
Well, Paula, I'll let you go attend to Harrison's needs.
I did attend to his needs. I sprayed him with a water bottle. His needs have more to do with his mental health than it has nothing to do with physical needs.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me today.
It was nice talking with you. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Yeah, bye. Comedian Paula Poundstone, she'll be performing at the Englert Theater in Iowa City Friday evening at 8 o'clock. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.